Case number 08-5085, National Association of Manufacturers Appellant versus Jeffrey Allen Taylor et al. Mr. Kirby for the appellant, Mr. Bagley for Appellees Jeffrey A. Taylor et al., and Mr. Carvalho for Appellees Nancy Erickson et al.
May it please the court, I have reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal. The National Association of Manufacturers is here challenging Section 207 of the Honest Leadership and Open Government Act, otherwise called HLOGA. It's challenging Section 207 to protect core First Amendment rights of speech, of petitioning the government, and of expressive association. It has challenged Section 207 on a number of grounds. That Section 207 has not been proven to have an adequate justifying interest, that it has not been shown to effectively serve any justifying interest, that it has not been shown to be tailored to avoid undue burden on First Amendment rights. But this morning, I'd like to begin by focusing on yet another fundamental flaw in Section 207, and that is that Section 207 is fatally vague. And of course, if a statute is fatally vague, then it doesn't matter if Congress has good purposes. Nothing else matters. In the First Amendment area, if you've got a vague statute, you've got an invalid statute. Section 207 requires groups like the National Association of Manufacturers that employ lobbyists to file public reports every calendar quarter. And in those public reports, they have to identify members who have contributed over $5,000 during the calendar quarter if the members meet certain criteria. The members, through their individuals who participate in the association's activities, must have actively participated in fostering lobbying contacts through acts that at the time they occurred were intended to foster, to advance, to support those lobbying contacts. And we are told by the government that the relevant intent...
Can I ask a question?
You said, surely, Your Honor.
I thought it was just intended for use in contacts, not to foster...
Okay, I accept that. You're correct, Your Honor. You're correct. The government tells us that the relevant intent is not the intent of the NAM and is not the intent of the individuals, but it's the intent of the corporate employers. And that's what the NAM has to assess in deciding whether or not these are acts that count toward deciding whether or not there has been active participation, which if there has been, then leads to public disclosure of that member's, corporate member's, participation in confidential expressive association activities by the NAM. This poses a virtually impossible burden on the NAM to implement the act honestly and accurately. Yet, the act threatens that if the NAM doesn't get it right, it potentially faces criminal liability with sentences up to 5 years in jail, plus hundreds of thousands of dollars in civil fines.
On the criminal side, it has to be knowing and corruptly.
It so does, Your Honor.
It can't just be if they don't get it right.
Well, that is correct, that the government's charge would have to be knowing and corrupt, and they would have to prove it. But the issue would be, did the NAM know the intent of the member at the time that the employee was acting, and then did it add it up right to figure out whether or not there was active participation?
The requirement of knowing in that circumstance seems to help you substantially, right?
Well, it's not really.
If it is as difficult as you say, then they won't be able to prove knowing, and they certainly won't be able to prove corruptly under the circumstances you're describing.
Well, first, Your Honor, I'm not sure that's true. The Supreme Court has been clear that knowingly goes to did you know the underlying facts, not did you evaluate the facts the same way the jury ultimately did.
But there's two possibilities for knowing. Sometimes it has to do with knowing that it's illegal under the law, and sometimes it's just knowing the facts.
Nobody has suggested that this statute requires an actual awareness it's unlawful under the law, Your Honor. And I don't remember the name of the Supreme Court case, but just in the last year or two, the U.S. Supreme Court made pretty clear that absent some other compelling indications, knowingly means awareness of the facts.
For example, in the Noftziger case, this court held that because of the First Amendment issue, or at least of the right to petition issue with respect to the contacts he was making with the government, that there would have to be evidence that he knew that his activities came under the statute, and that was different because it was the First Amendment, and that would affect the way in which the court should interpret the scienter requirement, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And if that standard were imposed, that would obviously help. Unless the government were allowed, the prosecutors, the enforcement authorities, were allowed nevertheless to try to infer knowledge that it must have been illegal from knowledge of the facts. Because then you still have this problem that when you're deciding whether or not to engage in core activity, you have to ask yourself, how is the government and how are the enforcement authorities later going to evaluate the intent that they say I must have known? You still don't have an objective, bright-line standard that allows people who want to engage in core First Amendment activity to confidently decide in advance whether they can go ahead and engage in that activity. Instead, what you've got is a situation where the NAM, by the way, has nearly 11,000 corporate members. It is member-driven. The members participate in the NAM through employees. Those employees of the members are very active. There are 100 meetings a month. There are all sorts of teleconferences and things like that going on. And the NAM is going to be required to judge as to each of those employees and ultimately as to each of their employers whether their various acts, at the time those various acts occurred, were intended for use in connection with lobbying contacts, and if they were, whether those had to add up to active participation. That is a very heavy burden, and it has the following effects. First, because the NAM does not want to expose itself to liability, the NAM has a strong pressure to over-report. If there's any possibility that a member's activity might be reportable, the statutory pressure is for the NAM to report that member. That means that the NAM can't confidently, it means two things. The NAM cannot confidently tell its corporate members what activities of their employees are going to end up leading to that member being disclosed. And it means that
the only disclosure is that they're a member of NAM, right? That's the only disclosure that's required.
No, sorry, Your Honor. It's a disclosure that they're a member of NAM and that they have actively participated in the NAM's lobbying activities.
I thought there was, I'm going to use the catchphrase safe harbor, but I appreciate you don't think it's very safe, but that you can put the name on the internet site as a member. Isn't that sufficient? And you don't then have to say whether they actively participate or not.
What, sort of, Your Honor. First, if you put all of your members on the internet and simply always refer back to the list of all of your members, then you are covered. Yes, that is correct. Secondly, you can put the list of those members who have actively participated in lobbying activities on the internet and cross-reference to them. Now, the first option...
We'll leave out the first option. There's a second option that I'm interested in, which is at the end of Section 1603, that no disclosure is required under Paragraph 3B. That's the one we've been talking about. If the organization that would be identified as affiliated with the client is listed on the client's publicly accessible internet website as being a member of or contributor to the client, and that's all.
That's right? Correct. But here's the problem, Your Honor. Either you have a list of everybody, or you have a changing list quarter by quarter. If you have a changing list,
you could, for example, as I understand, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
You're the judge; you get to do that.
Okay, but you're the lawyer; you get a chance to answer. Don't worry. I think in your paper say that you had to list 65 or something like that in order
first
to be
quarter.
Careful. You could have just listed them on this internet site and just left them there as members until they stop paying their dues or something, and that would end it for them, right?
Well, we could. I mean, we could put half of our members on the internet and hope that we always had the right people in that list, or simply add people to that list or change people from that list. But the point is, the NAM's membership list as such has been confidential for 100 years.
But you're not saying that all of the members or the large percentage of the members of the NAM are actively participating in lobbying, are you?
I'm saying that a substantial number are, and it changes quarter by quarter. And moreover, Your Honor, remember the impact of the $5,000 here. That's assessed quarter by quarter, too. So the 65 that were listed in the NAM's first calendar report were the 65 who were actively participating and whose anniversary dates had come up during that quarter so that they had paid their dues during that quarter so that they were subject to disclosure. So you have the second quarter, it turned out, we had only approximately 20 members that we ended up identifying, but with one exception, they were different than the 65 that we identified the first quarter. The reason being, those 65, of course, had paid their dues on their anniversary dates during the first quarter. The 20-something happened to have anniversary dates during the second quarter. That's when their money came in, so that's when they ended up getting reported. So the point, if I may digress a second from the vagueness point, because I think this is another very interesting aspect of the statute, and it's discussed on pages 13, I think, of our opening brief. The disclosures compelled here are so patchwork and virtually random. If Congress really needs to know who is providing active support for legislation, why is it that they only require disclosure if in a given calendar quarter money happens to coincide with activity? You have all sorts of ways that people can end up not being disclosed simply by manipulating when they give the money and when they actively participate, or simply choosing to do one or the other. Give huge sums of money dedicated to the lobbying effort, but not actively participate. They don't get disclosed. Give no money and dedicate 25 people full time.
This question of whether Congress has, now you're off of the vagueness point.
I want to come back to it, but yeah, I am off for the second.
This is what we addressed in Blount, and we said that the Supreme Court's, even its strict scrutiny test, does not require that Congress plug every loophole, and that it regulate more speech and more money in order to be justified, and if all it wants to do is regulate less. So I'm not sure that that's your winner.
Well, where this gets me, Your Honor, and you're right, it's off the vagueness point that I want to come back to. But where it gets me to is the argument of whether a justifying interest has been shown. And the Supreme Court has said where you have under-inclusiveness of a type that raises genuine doubts as to whether or not this Congress views the interest as important, then that is troubling under-inclusiveness. And here you have to ask yourself, what is it that Congress importantly needs to know that the operation of this statute reliably lets Congress know? And if the answer is not much, then I think your conclusion is whatever the interest is that's being pursued here isn't a very important interest and doesn't justify burdening the core First Amendment rights. Because we really are talking here, the core of the First Amendment. We're talking about people within an association organized to exercise First Amendment rights, talking about government employees, talking about government programs, talking about how to petition the government to resolve their grievances. There is no more central part of the First Amendment than what is being burdened here. And where I was going to bring myself back to vagueness, Your Honor, because that's what I want to focus on, is I just, in my remaining 1 minute and 55 seconds, asked the court to focus on the operation of the NAM as Ms. Amundson's uncontroverted declaration described it. You have these employees coming to hundreds of meetings, talking to one another, talking on the phone. How in the world is the NAM supposed to, on a real-time basis, monitor what each of those employees is doing, decide whether at the time that they do their various things, their employer actually intends for that work to be used in a lobbying context? Indeed, how do you decide what a corporation's intent really is in this situation?
Why don't you back to the scienter issue you discussed with Judge Garland?
Well, what we're proving, Your Honor, is that ultimately it might be hard for the government to prove a violation. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that the government can't bring a charge. And the Supreme Court over and over again in the First Amendment vagueness area has said, you have a couple of interests you're protecting here. One is fair notice. But beyond that, it's avoiding the need to hedge, trim, and steer clear. And beyond that, it's making sure that enforcement authorities don't have sort of broad discretion to punish people by bringing charges that can't easily be dismissed. You don't want a situation where the enforcement personnel can effectively and substantially punish folks by bringing claims under statutes that are sufficiently unclear that you can't get rid of the claims that lack merit. And that's the problem we have here. I cast no aspersions on the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia at this time. I have no idea in 2 years or 4 years.
You cast no aspersions at this time or the U.S. Attorney at this time?
I mean, on the U.S. Attorney who is holding office at this time. But we don't know who's going to be the U.S. Attorney with respect in 2 years or 4 years. And remember, once we file a report, for 5 years, the NAM is hanging out there, subject to prosecution by whatever U.S. Attorney comes into office during that period. The NAM does not want to expose itself, its employees, to anything, and it wants to obey the law. The NAM wants to obey the law. That's one of its platform planks, is that corporations should obey the law. And it has been subjected here to a law at the very core of the First Amendment where, Your Honors, it simply has no confidence.
Let me ask you this. If the consequence of such ambiguities as you perceive in the requirements is that a prudent tendency to over-report, is that a harm? That would seem to solve the ambiguity problem, but does it cause a harm in itself?
It does cause a harm in itself, Your Honor, because it deters the members who don't want to be reported from participating in the NAM.
That's true whether you over-report or cut it close to the line.
No, Your Honor, if you cut it close to the line, then at least they can adjust their employee activities. Mm-hmm. First, they can adjust their employee activities so that they don't end up getting reported. They can do a lot, maybe not as much as they'd like, but they can do some. The NAM also can structure its operations so that it can assure members as to many activities, if your employees come and do just this, you're going to be okay. But the problem we have is with such a vague statute, we can't give our members those assurances. We can't tell them if your employees just do this or just participate in this program. There's a big zone where to be safe. We either have to, as NAM, not host the programs, or to be safe, the members have to say we don't want our employees participating.
Is it your view that active participation is a redundancy? It really means any participation?
No, Your Honor. I think active participation fairly is read to mean substantial activity.
What would passive participation be?
Well,
that an oxymoron.
Passive participation would perhaps be getting a notice saying, unless you object, we're going to assume that you support these programs. I mean, passive participation can't be anything this gets to the problem in the legislative history. Passive participation is participation that isn't active, and I don't mean to make light of the court's question, but I think when you by using the word active participation, which to some extent those terms are redundant, active participation is a way I think of saying substantial participation, which then leads to the whole problem of what's substantial. How substantial does it have to be? If it's different employees at different times, how do you add that up to determine if there's substantiality? I don't know what active participation means. When the Supreme Court faced it that one time in the letter carrier's case.
Harris?
No. Harris was the case that upheld very constrained reporting with respect to lobbying if you were communicating only with members and only with respect to legislation or proposed legislation. The letter carrier's case, I think, was under the Hatch Act.
Those dimensions don't affect the degree of participation.
No. I was talking about the letter carrier's case, which I think arose under the Hatch Act, and I believe it was at a time when the letter carriers were still government employees, Your Honor. It's cited in the briefs. And there the question was whether the term forbidding active participation in partisan activity was sufficiently clear to be used in regulating First Amendment activity. And to sustain that, the Supreme Court said, well, yeah, the language may be difficult, but by the time this claim has come before us, there are 3,000 adjudications plus regulations that clarify that. And given that we have that additional clarification of the term, we can sustain the standard. Here we don't have 3,000 adjudications of what active participation means under this statute. And so we just have the naked language that the court found so troubling.
The only explanation that the court gave. You would think that if there were 3,000 adjudications, that might make it more vague rather than less. Mm-hmm. The only explanation the court gave was to list the regulations, but the regulations just, you know, they define active participation as taking an active part.
Well, that is why, Your Honor, they do also.
And the court said that was good enough, taking an active part in managing the political campaign, taking an active part in political management of a political campaign. I mean, that doesn't strike me as that much of a difference. And if the court thought that was enough, then
well,
I'm not sure.
Your Honor, with respect,
yes,
my reading of the case, and I can go get it if we want to work our way through it, is that the court also emphasized that there were behind these regulations. These regulations had been distilled from and were to be understood in light of this extensive body of precedent. And I will say, Your Honor, that subsequent cases, we cite a Second Circuit case, I recall, have understood the way we can make sense of this is the Supreme Court was placing heavy reliance on that substantial body of adjudication. So my point there is simply the words on their face are very difficult to understand, and we do not have any useful clarification.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Nicholas Bagley for the Department of Justice. The Supreme Court has repeatedly confirmed that laws requiring the disclosure of the identities of the corporate contributors to lobbyists and to political associations are, as a general matter, constitutional, so long as they bear a substantial relation to an important governmental interest. The Lobbying Disclosure Act, as amended by Section 207, serves at least two such interests, enhancing good governance and promoting public confidence in government officials. And the LDA does so by increasing the fund of information available to the public and to government officials about the real parties in interest behind lobbying efforts. And NAM comes before us and says Section 207 is unconstitutional because several of our members may face retaliation should their disclosure become known. It's important to note that NAM actually provided no evidence of any such retaliation at the district court. Indeed, it didn't even make a concrete allegation that any particular member actually subject to disclosure, in fact, faced such a risk. Absent such evidence, as the Supreme Court held in Buckley, NAM's as-applied challenge to Section 207 must fail. I'd be happy to address any of the questions that were raised on the vagueness point, but I'd be happy to leave that to my congressional counterpart. On the associational interests,
Why don't you do that?
Great.
Why don't you address it?
Great. It's very difficult for me to understand.
Answer his argument that this is just very too difficult for them to figure out what the intent requirement and the.
So there are two points. The first is that the term lobbying activities is defined to mean lobbying contacts, which is in turn defined by the statute, and then activities in support of such contacts that were intended to be in support of such contacts. And the word intent there focuses on distinguishing between efforts that were unrelated to lobbying at the time they were conducted and efforts that were, in fact, directed at lobbying efforts. So in the normal case, you'd imagine a NAM member would write a report. At the time, it would be pretty clear to NAM whether or not that was intended to support its efforts to engage in lobbying. It's very difficult to imagine that the member would simply provide the report and say, hey, I don't know what this is for, but, you know, use it for whatever you see fit. I furthermore note that the scienter requirement is certainly relevant to determining whether or not relevant intent could be proved. I think an honest mistake here is very unlikely to give rise to liability. I further note that Congress has, in fact, given pretty extensive guidance as to what the term actively participates means, and that Section 3 of the guidance that it released and revised as of July 16th, 2008. I could read that to the court if that would be useful.
Here?
It's Section 3 of the guidance that Congress issued and revised as of July 16th, 2008. It's available on its website.
The plaintiff argues that congressional description of the guidance through congressional staff is separation of powers question, or in any event doesn't in the end control the U.S. Attorney's decisions.
Does it control, not in any formal legal sense, but I think the vagueness inquiry is a lot more sort of practically oriented. You're asking whether or not a party whether or not a statute is so unintelligible that a party fears prosecution should he engage in particular activities. And the likelihood that the U.S. attorney is going to bring a lawsuit against a lobbying organization that has conformed with its understanding of the law as instructed by Congress particularly given...
Did the Congress pass this guideline?
My understanding is that the Secretary and the Clerk of the House and the Senate cooperated to release these guidelines. I don't think it was voted on.
So it's not, I mean, it doesn't even rise to the level of a defect such as legislative history, which wasn't voted on. This postdates the enactment of the statute.
Well, it's offering a set of guidelines about how Congress is going to do its part to enforce the statute, which is to say, when it receives lobbying disclosures, it's the party that reviews them and says whether or not they're sort of in conformity with the law as a first cut. Any problems it sees, it then refers to the U.S. Attorney's Office. So the U.S. Attorney...
This is the appropriate party saying we will refer the following types of matters and not others.
Congress establishes these guidelines so that it can tell the difference between...
Well, I don't know what the Congress. You said these two officials.
The Secretary and the Clerk of the House,
right.
Yes.
And they're the ones who, under the statute, are charged with making referrals to the U.S. Attorney?
That is my understanding, yes.
And is that the only source of potential cases for the U.S. Attorney?
The U.S. Attorney is not limited to filing those cases. The U.S. Attorney could freelance and bring a suit on his own. I'm aware of no such cases that have been brought, and I think it's pretty unlikely that... you would have to imagine a case where a lobbyist conformed his actions not only to his understanding of the law, but also to the congressional guidance that was established. And the U.S. Attorney says, I disagree with that. I think they got it wrong. And in fact, I think they got it so wrong that this lobbyist is actually in violation of the law. So I think it's very difficult to see that as a practical threat of prosecution, especially because the term intended for use in lobbying activities is going to be extraordinarily clear in the vast majority of cases. And the Supreme Court made clear this past term in Williams that the fact that there are some closed cases on the margins is not a reason to strike a statute down as vague.
So what you're saying about the guidance issued by the clerk and the other party really, I guess, goes to the difficulty that the U.S. Attorney would have in showing a knowing violation in light of that guidance.
I think it might go to that. I think it would go to the practical likelihood that a U.S. Attorney would actually decide to bring such a suit.
Can you get advice from the congressional office?
My understanding is there is back and forth between the congressional office and lobbyists, but I think my colleague would be better addressed equipped to answer that.
Okay. Thank you.
May it please the court, Thomas Caballero for the Secretary of the Senate and the Clerk of the House. I want to make very quick points on some of the questions the court has raised. I think the first point is to look at the statute that's being challenged itself and the term lobbying activities. What disclosure is required under the HLOGA Section 207 amendment is not a disclosure of those organizations who participate in the lobbying activities of the NAM. It's disclosure of those organizations who participate in planning, supervising, and controlling those lobbying activities. So the question isn't figuring out whether an organization who assisted in lobbying was intending to do so when it did that assistance, an issue that I don't think is a difficult question for vagueness. But it's even further removed. It's a question of which organizations actively participate in managing your lobbying and making decisions for your lobbying. And that's what NAM is being asked to figure out. Secondly, on the question the court raised of passive participation, the statement of the three main co-sponsors gave an example of passive participation, which would be an organization that merely receives newsletters from the Legislative Affairs Office of an association. I'm a member of NAM. NAM sends quarterly reports of its lobbying activities. That is passive participation. Or if NAM sends out a survey and asks all of its members, what legislative issues do you think that NAM should focus on this year, a general survey, and I respond to that, that's passive participation. That's not the level of participation Congress was attempting to have disclosed here. And Congress purposely put in these thresholds of money and active participation to exclude those minimal situations. One point to make on the guidance that is issued by the congressional officials is they issue that subject to a statutory direction. The statute directs the secretary and clerk to issue that guidance. And I think its most relevance for the vagueness inquiry is it's a demonstration that persons of ordinary intelligence can understand and apply the language in the statute regarding lobbying activities and acts of participation in a reasonable way, which is the test.
Do they give advisory opinions?
They do not give advisory opinions. They do set out examples in the guidance.
No, no. Can a lobbyist go to the, what is it, the clerk? Is that what
it's the clerk or the secretary. A lobbyist can call up. They do not, they're not legal officials who provide legal advisory opinions. They help them understand the filing requirements, but they do not give advisory opinions.
No preclearance?
No, there's no preclearance mechanism. I thank the court.
Thank you, Mr. Kirby. Give you a minute, Mr. Kirby.
I'm sorry?
Would you like a minute for rebuttal?
Your Honor, I think I'm happy with your stand unless the court has questions.
I think we're pretty happy, too. Thank you. It's a happy day. Case is submitted.